Hi, this is Tamson Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamson and Dan Read the Paper. It's Sunday afternoon of May 13th, 2018. Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there, and especially to my own mother, Vivian Granger.
Yeah, happy Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to you, Tamson.
Thank you. So it's kind of a gloomy Mother's Day here in Lineport.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that's okay.
It is a gloomy Mother's Day.
Because I love a rainy day.
Well, good. Then you're
and
having
the
a
garden's
great day.
Been dry, and yes. I just did some planting.
And now it's totally overblown. So, it's like a jungle out here.
Right. So I'm basically happy as a pig in poop.
Okay. Good. It's well put. So another eventful week. We were at the theater again on Thursday. We saw the Encores production of Me and My Girl, which, as we mentioned last week, is a 1930s English musical-type musical, which was fashioned for Broadway in the mid-80s, had some real success, played for 3 or 4 years, and Encores does sort of weekend concert revivals, though this was hardly a concert revival, but had full-blown dance numbers, and they put a lot into this production.
It was a real production.
Yeah. With some real stars, and in particular, Christian Borle was in it, and the second lead, a woman named Laura Michelle Kelly. The costumes, everything looked like a Broadway show. And there was only one thing missing, which was the show, which which was not good. Why was it not good? It was because it was this pastiche that had been put together again between the 30s and the 80s, and apparently it never made much sense, but people apparently thought it was a lot of fun in the 1980s. I don't know why, but we found ourselves sitting there throughout the first act, seeing number after number, loosely connected by plot or character, without much in the way of inspiring music or interesting lyrics, the crowd seemed to be eating it up.
Yes, I was mystified. It was well received by the crowd.
Right.
I was a little worried because I was pretty disappointed.
Right.
And I was assuming that you were enjoying it and you were going to explain it all to me later.
At halftime, at intermission. So the crowd was, you know, cheering at intermission. And I didn't know that's what you were thinking, but I did turn to you right away and said, I don't get it. Because this isn't good.
We didn't get it. It's hard to really comment. I think it was just, it's a particular style of musical.
Yeah.
Just one number after the next. None of them particularly memorable.
No.
And no clever lyrics.
I mean, Christian Borle was, did yeoman's work. It's largely comic. He's a great comic actor and he's a wonderful dancer. But he seemed miscast as an English musical type figure. And I will say this. What we tend to do after the shows, you see him on a Thursday night, or we see him on a Thursday night.
You go to the restroom.
And then you listen to everyone else. Everybody loves it in the restroom.
Yes.
And
everybody loved it. So I think everybody had a good time with us.
But just to finish, so then we check the review, because the Times review appears on Friday morning. And the Times review was bad. It's terrible. It's not very good. And look, I'm not going to say that, because we disagree with the Times a lot, so I'm not going to say, oh, we were right because the New York Times saw it the same way we did. But I think the Times was on the ball here. I don't quite get it. I mean, it's just not, doesn't succeed on almost any level that I can think of. Look, Encores, we still enjoy Encores. It wasn't that unpleasant evening.
I mean, last time we had no expectations about Grand Hotel.
Grand Hotel was far
superior.
And
there were no memorable songs there.
Right.
And yet we had a wonderful time.
And I would say at least 2 out of 3 Encores performances are really good, which is a tremendous percentage. And for a lot of people, I think it may be higher than 2 out of 3.
Yeah.
I think it may be higher. But it didn't register for us. So
okay.
There you go. There was an article in the both the the Journal and the Times on the same subject, and there's a reason for it, I suppose. Yeah, here's the reason for it.
Same subject?
The same subject.
What we don't like about Encores?
No, the demise of the Broadway musical. which sounds like a tired subject.
That sounds like something people have been writing about since 1922.
Right, but it just sounds like sour apples, except here's what I guess sparked the latest round. You know, the Tony Awards are coming up, and they're going to be given in a week or two. There is a group called the New York Drama Critics Circle, and that's comprised of, guess what, New York Drama Critics. And they vote awards around the same time of year, as a matter of fact, this time of year, for Best Play, Best Musical, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And their award this year for Best Musical was nothing. They said, we're not giving an award for Best Musical this year.
Really?
Nothing.
Really?
And you say to yourself,
but you know, this doesn't make any sense to me.
But let me just pause 1 second. One fact out there. You say Band's Visit. Band's Visit won last year for them. Okay?
Right.
So they're not commenting on the Band's Visit.
Right.
But they're saying nothing else. We'd rather give no award.
And yet people are going to Broadway musicals in droves.
They are. And they're going to properties. Well, here's the way the vote broke down. They have 19 critics, right?
Yeah.
Two of them voted for SpongeBob SquarePants out of 19. The other 17 were not interested. One of them voted for Mean Girls, one out of 19.
Yeah.
The rest of them, nobody voted for Frozen. These were all nominated for Tonys for Best Musical.
Right.
And nobody else was interested in voting for these. They say these are non-starters as far as we're concerned because to us, these are synthetic pop scores. You hear that phrase. You hear that they're just properties designed for children. They're just commercial properties that are being exploited to, you know, put a few ditty, whatever you want. And look, I don't want to be too negative here because we even know people who like SpongeBob SquarePants.
The musicals in the first half of the 20th century were all art.
Well,
they weren't commercial. No one was trying to make any money.
Well, no, it's always about making money. Look, it's a confusing subject.
It's a very confusing subject.
The thing that touches us off is the drama critic circle. They're there to give awards. And the fact that they can't get themselves to give an award tells you something is up. I mean, there's a theory. The Wall Street Journal theory is this. That's by a fellow named Terry Teachout. And he says, look, it used to be that there was a consistency between Broadway musicals and pop music, that all the great recording artists at that time, Frank Sinatra, would record Broadway musical songs. It reaches, you know, apex in the late 50s, early 60s. We had a common culture, and you staged big musicals and put them on. And the last musical to achieve that status in Teachout's mind was 1964, Fiddler on the Roof. Apparently Sondheim didn't make a ripple. So nothing after that, as far as he's concerned. And everything since then, he says there's been some great shows since then. And he says, you know, Avenue Q, Dear Evan Hansen, Fun Home, Hamilton, Light in the Piazza. He credits all that. He says, but what those are regional theater productions or workshop productions, which were small scale, and inevitably were always small scale, and got lifted to Broadway, as opposed to the large-scale Deus Ex Machina, big production, like a Carousel or an Oklahoma or My Fair Lady, whatever, that comes in from the sky and is the big musical. So those we haven't seen for a long, long time. The Times just complains about the notion of a synthetic pop and these commercial properties that have built
commercials. Yeah. Commercial.
What can I tell you? That's the debate.
I think the stage was born commercial.
Okay. All right. Okay. I guess what it is.
Shakespeare woke up one day and said, I think I'll make art. Yeah. You know, the man wanted to pay his rent.
You're right. But I think what they're objecting to is the fact that it's a lack of creativity. If you're just saying the movie was popular, let's put words and music together. That whatever.
All right. You know, I'm right in there with, jukebox musicals may not be the most entertaining or interesting or clever. I agree, but there's a lot of stuff out there. I can't even deserve an award.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, there was a proposal this way, but put forward this year about whether jukebox musicals should be a separate category.
Right.
At the Tonys, and it was rejected in the Times view because it would be like having a category for terrible musicals. They didn't want to do that. But yeah, who knows? Maybe one day. All right. So
I have some health tips.
Yeah, I think that's
garnered
important.
From the New York Times this week.
Well, it must be correct.
Just as a public service.
Sure.
I feel I should make these known. Number one.
Yeah.
A little blurb in the health section. Saying saunas may cut the risk of stroke.
Hmm.
And research was done, studies were done on people taking traditional Finnish saunas. And they followed these people for 15 years. There were 155 strokes over the period. And the findings were that compared with the people who took, they found that compared with people who took saunas once a week, those who took them two or three times a week were 12% less likely to have a stroke. People who took saunas four to seven times a week cut their risk for stroke by 62%.
Well, that's impressive.
Okay, so they're not exactly sure why. Might have something to do with the temperature increases, reducing the inflammatory processes in the body, therefore reducing arterial stiffness.
Hmm.
So I know you love a sauna.
I took a sauna a couple hours ago.
And do your arteries feel less stiff?
Well, first of all, when you take a sauna, especially at a gym, you get to meet a lot of people you wouldn't otherwise meet wearing just a very small towel. So there is that. There is that excitement.
So you feel the social component is key.
It really enhances your life, if it doesn't lengthen your life. No, I enjoy saunas. I think they're relaxing and they're cleansing, right?
And now you know.
And now
it's healthier, but you really got to do it seven times a week, apparently.
Well, that's
and you can be super healthy.
Well, you're gonna
or you could take on five behaviors for a longer life.
All right, I'll try this. Go ahead.
Okay, so here's another study.
Yeah.
Published recently. Analyzing two large databases with 34 years of detailed health and lifestyle information on more than 123,000 men and women.
All right, I'm excited. Go ahead. What?
Okay. The study looked at five behaviors. All right.
Yeah, we discussed this. Go ahead. What are the five behaviors?
Eating a healthy diet.
All right.
Not smoking.
Mm-hmm.
Getting regular physical activity.
Mm-hmm.
Moderate alcohol consumption, mm-hmm. and maintaining a normal weight.
Yeah.
On average,
mm-hmm.
a 50-year-old man who adopted all of these would live 12 years longer than a man who took on none. A woman with the same five habits would live 14 years longer.
Really?
Than a woman with none. Okay.
Hmm.
The more low-risk factors a person had, the longer his or her projected lifespan. For example, a 50-year-old woman with four of the healthy factors could live to, on average, around 89. Those with three, only 87. Those with two, 84. But here's the odd thing. Unfortunately, less than 2% of the people studied had all five low-risk factors.
Really?
And a third had two or fewer.
Well, it wouldn't, first, number one, I think all that's doable. I think we kind of do it. So I'm glad to hear that. Number two, I'm interested that one of the factors not listed is getting regular medical checkups. I guess that didn't make the list. So all good. I mean, that makes perfect sense to me. Sometimes these things
make
sense.
But do you think moderate alcohol consumption means you should drink a little or you shouldn't drink a lot?
Yeah, we had that discussion. I don't know. I suspect they mean only moderate. I suspect.
Right? Okay.
I would guess.
Yeah, it doesn't seem too hard to do.
It seems
healthy
to be
eating, not smoking, physical
Here's the real question.
Activity.
The real question you're not answering, which applies to your husband. What happens if you do those five things and you take saunas?
Well, you're going to live a long and illustrious life.
Okay, there you go. Well, I don't know about illustrious. Okay, so here we go.
Well, you're one of like 2%
right.
who could manage that, so.
Well, here's something that we did. It was a little bit different yesterday to celebrate Mother's Day weekend. We saw Avengers Infinity Wars.
Mother's Day movie.
Mother's Day movie, that's exactly right. And we had not seen a very popular movie, the highest grossing movie of the last few months, zillions of dollars. And our kids saw it and cleared it for us. They said we would understand it.
They said we knew enough about the characters.
In life in general.
That we would get it.
And we would understand it. And indeed, they were correct. Although they credit us with quite a bit of ability there, because there were characters coming from all over. It was an all-star parade of superhero characters. And that's what the movie is. It collects characters from all kinds of movie franchises. And every time, every few scenes, there's a whole different group. And it looked like what are they doing in this movie? And yet they're together in this movie. So it's a fantastic display. And it was fun. I enjoyed it.
It was fun. It was funny. I had the same confusion I had with the movie Thor.
Yeah.
And that is, I don't know, there seems to be like a big battle, everybody dies, and there seems to be no way anybody can survive, including the hero.
Yeah.
And yet, he or she does.
Yeah.
And then a few minutes later, there's another big battle, and everybody dies.
Yeah.
You know, I can't quite keep up.
Well, first of all, surely you detected, having seen Thor, that Thor was sort of the top of the heap. Thor is as classy as it gets in this genre, right? And you saw a little less classy in a whole different array of characters here. But your point is definitely correct. It gets a little confusing. It's a little, how shall we say, cartoonish. But, you know, even worse than that, but it's consistent with what you're saying. What I had a problem with and have a problem with in some of the characters and some of the developments in the movies based on the Marvel comics is they're really running with the magical aspect of things. Okay?
Right.
Okay.
I don't understand how anybody, why are they even bothering with this hand-to-hand combat thing?
Right.
You know, if they can just flick their fingers.
Yeah, all right.
And, lasers come out.
Exactly.
Or whatever.
So it's an example. It's embodied by Benedict Cumberbatch,
yeah,
who plays Doctor Strange. Now, you could not pay me to see a so-called Doctor Strange movie, nor could you have paid me when I was 14 years old to read a Doctor Strange comic, nor anybody else 14 years old.
Because that's cheating when you think about it.
It doesn't make any sense. What you need in comic books even, and heroes and stuff, is some internal logic. Because people are bounded, and the easiest way to bound the characters is by human characteristics. They have human characteristics, but they're enhanced. So
then
bound
you have
character.
Some superpower,
right,
and this superpower can beat that superpower.
Right, but you still have to figure out, still has to work internally.
Like rock, paper, scissors.
Exactly.
Like and if that. You come along
and
with...
And someone walks in and says, you know something? What if I wave my hands this way, and we'll go back in time and we redo the... So no. Now it's childish. And that's the only thing Doctor Strange can do, if anything. It's not clear. I saw the movie. I don't know what he can do. Nor do I understand what the main villain can do or not do. And without doing spoiler alerts, there's a lot in the movie that you say to yourself, well, maybe these characters are dead now, but maybe they'll be revived because anything goes. And I guess that's the next movie, which is a sort of a disappointing
way. But it is
way.
Fun.
It's fun.
It's full of humor.
But the fanboys, the guys who take this seriously, if you get on the net, some of them are complaining about that. They said, what kind of movie is it? Is at the end of the movie, the cliffhanger is not even what's going to happen to this character, but how are the creators of the next movie going to explain the reviving of these characters? That's a very odd way to do it. That's not really investing in the characters. So I find it ultimately intellectually disappointing, or let me put it the other way, the comic books are a little more intellectual than the movie. But be that as it may, as you put it, it's not about anything but making a successful entertainment and bringing in dough, and that they've done.
All right.
And I enjoyed it.
All right. And so did I.
Yeah.
And we had a nice dinner, and we had a nice glass of wine, etc. And this morning, I'm reading about wine in the Wall Street Journal, and it's the column by Letty Teague. And actually, she addresses the shape of wine bottles.
Yeah.
So this is right up my alley, because not being a connoisseur, you know, I easily fall into the trap of, ooh, that's a cool bottle. Why don't I try it,
really?
That one?
That's disappointing.
You know? No, but, well, I'm sorry you're disappointed. I'm not, but it's clear.
Don't look at me. You're the wine buyer.
But what's fun about it, what's interesting, since I'm not knowledgeable about wine, I did learn a lot about the bottles from her column. And one of the things she explains is, there's actually a Burgundy bottle, a Bordeaux bottle, a slender taper needle nose bottle that is favored by Moselle, Germany, and Alsace. I mean, and you've seen all these, and they make some internal sense. And so not only do you use the Burgundy bottle with Burgundy wine, not only do the Burgundy people use it, but anybody using those kind of grapes, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Pinot Gris, use that shape of a bottle. It's
functional.
How would you describe it? It's a slope shoulder.
But is it because it's functional? Because that's the way you recognize it.
Well, it is functional to some extent. For instance, the Bordeaux bottle, which is used with wines like Cabernet Merlot, Cabernet Franc, we should say, the well-structured, often tannic wines, has a high shoulder. Okay, so those are the taller ones, and then the neck is a little shorter.
Right.
You've seen them, and you always, you look at them, you say, ooh, that's a classy bottle, I'll buy that. The high shoulder is supposed to catch some of the sediment.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so it does have a function.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the problem is, and she does try a variety of fun bottles, okay? One is especially not memorable, and that is the Lady Lola Pinot Grigio, which has a very cool bottle that one wine seller says, if you don't like the wine, at least you have the bottle. You can use it for olive oil or something. It actually has a reusable stopper, and she finds that completely unremarkable. Tastes like water, basically. But she does end up saying that a distinctive wine in a distinctive bottle does not happen often. But when it does, beyond the pleasure of drinking the wine, who wouldn't be pleased to be enjoying the bottle itself or even recycling some aspect of it as a cookie press? And she comes up with a couple that actually do taste pretty good. Apparently, one of the popular wines to have crazy bottles is rosé, because rosé is very popular. At the moment, there are a lot of rosés out there, so they're all jockeying, vying for position. Mm-hmm. And feel maybe a cool bottle will get them a niche.
Yeah, so well, certainly get people looking.
But anyway, I thought it was interesting, the actual functional aspects of the classic bottles, more so than the unique bottles. But I'll still buy the odd bottles, just for fun. Really nice review of a book about Central Park. The book is Saving Central Park by Elizabeth Barlow Rogers. Mm-hmm. The review is by Witold Rybczynski. Rybczynski? He's a known writer. I apologize for the pronunciation. He wrote a great biography of Olsted a few years ago. That was called, I should just mention this in case, A Clearing in the Distance.
So he's still writing about Central Park then, because Olmsted is Central Park.
Yeah, well, he's always going to write about Central Park. Okay. He's always going to write about Olmsted and aspects. Although his latest book is actually about a history of chairs.
Oh.
And it's called Now I Sit Me Down.
Oh.
Okay. He's actually in the Philadelphia area.
Really?
He's a professor emeritus from Penn. Anyway. Elizabeth Barlow Rogers was actually the first administrator of Central Park. Mm-hmm. Now, we love Central Park.
Right.
One of the first great public parks. Mm-hmm. And it was started, construction was started in 1858 and completed around 1873. And it was designed by Frederick Law Olmsted and Calvert Vaux.
Yeah.
It's one of the first great parks. The concept of public park was new, okay? The first public parks were sort of cemeteries, purpose-built cemeteries. Mm-hmm. When churchyards were running out of room for burying the dead, people started actually creating cemeteries where anybody could be buried. For a fee. And this was a new concept. And they were often, quasi-arboretum as well. You would plant trees there. There would be beautiful park-like settings. People would come and picnic in the cemeteries.
So the arboretum was around where the graves were?
No, it was just the way they were landscaped.
Oh, okay.
They would have lovely trees and plantings. Mm-hmm. And people even, you would go visit, the tombs of your loved ones, perhaps. But even people without any connection would go there because they were nice places. They would be on the outskirts of cities like Philadelphia, Laurel Hill.
No, I was just going to think of Laurel Hill.
One of the early ones, 1837.
Right. So I remember
At a certain point, they actually sold tickets to get in.
Oh, really?
Because it was so overcrowded with people wanting to get out of the filthy, dirty cities with, no green space to relax in the park.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's in that 19th century time that people began to see there is an important place for parks in a city like New York City. Okay. So they build this fantastic park. Almost the minute it's done, Tammany Hall loses interest. Okay. And there's no money for keeping it up. So by the early 1900s, the park was an abandoned ruin. I mean, it was an amazing structure. This changes with Fiorella LaGuardia, okay, who appoints your friend and mine, Robert Moses. And Moses does a lot of crazy stuff. He initiates a lot of recreational facilities that Olmsted never envisioned. Mm-hmm. Okay, Olmsted is, you know, doing wonderful natural settings. He's mm-hmm. crafting nature in the city. Mm-hmm. And Moses is, you know, putting in ballparks and playgrounds, skating rinks, things like that. And perhaps he destroyed a bit of some of the natural mm-hmm. elegance of the original park, but he really, you know, he definitely opened it up to, you know, even more usage. He was not at all interested in conservation, but he understood maintenance. He mm-hmm. understood that this huge park had to be maintained. So there was that. Next guy involved is Thomas Hovey, okay, who, you know, will be the great director of the Met. Right. For years. And he's the one who brings all those things. Remember, we used to go to the park to listen to the opera mm-hmm. and other kinds of concerts? Okay. He brings all these events, all rock and roll, to the park, which is a tremendous strain on the facilities, brings people in like crazy. And then, as New York is descending into bankruptcy during the 70s, again, it falls into ruin. Graffiti. It's right. a scary place. And, you know, when we lived there in New York, it was somewhat scary. You know, the idea of walking across Central Park.
Well, you
don't
go in there
Park.
At night, sure.
Well, but, you know, I used to run there at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, that was borderline.
But I figured that...
you were running.
Yeah, that no criminals were up then.
Right.
So anyway, but it was, you know, it was a, kind of ugly. And along comes Elizabeth Barlow Rogers, who's appointed by Ed Koch. Mm-hmm. And she sort of single-handedly, and she her position isn't even paid, okay? Mm-hmm. But she's become renowned because she has written about Olmsted and others. And she actually, I think, creates the conservancy. She's the one who finds the private funds to actually instigate all this renovation that mm-hmm. makes the park the beautiful place it is today. She's able to, in the beginning, raise $100 million of private money, which now is up to $1 billion. Mm-hmm. And so she, you know, understood the important link between this public facility and private funding and facilitated that. So it sounds like her book is quite interesting, detailing all of that. And of course, again, the city didn't have anywhere near the resources to deal with this renovation. And so it's the conservancy who hires landscape architects, historians, finds volunteers.
Well, look, when there's money around, you know, you can do it. I mean, but when the city was in hard times, it's not a priority.
It's just an amazing thing. Obviously, the park has gone through ups and downs.
And I think there will be more
and
ups and
it
downs.
It is
sure.
an exquisite place.
Right.
We love to go there. First, you know, especially early on a Sunday morning when all the dog walkers are out. And it is an amazing
but it does
public
facility. It does reflect the financial fortunes of the city. It does go up and down with that, and it will go up and down with that again, I suspect.
But it also underlines the necessity for maintenance.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, but great art
it
needs
costs
great
money.
Maintenance.
Yeah, that's not the sexiest thing in the world, but yes, I'm sure that's
it's
true.
It's not, but that's what makes it sexy.
Yeah. All right. We don't want to dwell on this. It's sort of a continuation story, but there's a book involved. To Kill a Mockingbird. There's a new book, which is called, strangely enough, Atticus Finch, the Biography, by a fellow named Joseph Crespino. And it all ties in, of course, with the work by Harper Lee. Now, we had talked before about the fact that there's going to be a play on Broadway written by Aaron Sorkin on To Kill a Mockingbird. And there was a dispute leading to a lawsuit about that because apparently what Sorkin had done was somehow alter or modify to some degree the Atticus Finch character in To Kill a Mockingbird
right.
in a way that the estate of Harper Lee didn't like. And they had a contract which said that the character would not be modified. And we said here, I said here before, that I think there's something to that lawsuit. The Times has a headline in the paper this week on Friday, Broadway's Mockingbird survives court challenge over script. And I say, boy, I guess the Broadway team won that lawsuit. I'm surprised. I thought there was something to it. And of course, when you read the Times article, it turns out they didn't win the lawsuit. They settled the lawsuit, which is, in the legal world, kind of the opposite often of winning the lawsuit. So sometimes the Times headline writers and the article writers have to get together. But in any event, they settled the lawsuit. Money changed hands, possibly. It's a secret. And maybe they changed the dialogue. That's a secret, too. But it gets you to the deeper conflict, which is the one that was set up when Come a Watchman was published. And Watchman was the book published a few years ago under Harper Lee's name. And that showed a different type of Atticus Finch, one who was supposedly somewhat prejudiced. And apparently Sorkin was leaning on that when he modified the character. And here's the dispute. But it takes us back to what's going on with this character. And number one, just a couple quick points. It turns out that Come a Watchman was not a sequel or prequel or a second book written by Harper Lee. It was the first book.
Really?
It was the draft. It was what she wanted to have published. And that didn't meet with much acclaim. And the publishers came back and say, this is not going to sell. We're not interested. And as she worked some more, she eventually came up with To Kill a Mockingbird and distilled and refined the character into this saint-like figure, which was Gregory Peck / Atticus Finch. And as popular as it was, they quote in the journal review of the book, they say, you know, Flannery O'Connor, a great short story writer of the time, dismissed To Kill a Mockingbird, quote, as a children's book, which the journal says it is. And it is, because he's not a human being. He's just a singular paragon of virtue, and that's not the way people truly are. And they make the point, and this is somewhat interesting, that Atticus Finch is based so much so on Harper Lee's father that it's almost exactly the same. He was a journalist and a lawyer who tried a case in which he defended African-American defendants in an unfair trial, and they were convicted unfairly and punished unfairly. It's the same experience depicted in To Kill a Mockingbird. And then they try to draw on, what was he exactly like? Did he have these same conflicts as you see when you see the Watchmen book juxtaposed next to Kill a Mockingbird? They say he did, because notwithstanding that he took this case and defended the rights of black people, on the other hand, he had other positions which he didn't want the federal authorities meddling, as he put it, with respect to anti-lynching laws and the like. And I can tell you, as a lawyer, I can see that, because you sometimes would take the view, it's a states' rights thing, we'll straighten it out ourselves. So I wonder if it's all a little more complicated than perhaps even Harper Lee understood about her father, because it's very easy for me to see someone who was a Southerner at the time saying, you know something, we'll work it out. I do object to the ways people are behaving here, but we'll work it out on our own, as opposed to having the feds come in. I think that's probably the answer to all this. But in any event, we'll see. We'll have a chance to see how Aaron Sorkin resolves it all when you see To Kill a Mockingbird on Broadway in the fall.
All right, complex story.
Yeah. You had something about... The auction.
Well, we have a lot of updates.
Yes.
A lot of updates.
Oh, yes.
Okay, the first... I guess we can do the auction first.
Yeah.
Update on the David Rockefeller auction.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, it has cleared $832 million.
Well, that's something.
Okay. There's still more to be sold. The online aspects of the auction were continuing to go on. So it broke previous records.
Yeah.
It went beyond almost all the reserves. So that's very good. It, you know, there are people who say it wasn't quite the blockbuster.
That's a blockbuster.
A certain percentage, at least a third of the big sales were to guarantors. So somebody had already guaranteed a bid
like
of a particular amount on a particular piece.
Well,
a lot of the big pieces were in effect pre-sold.
Well, you told me, we discussed it. You said there were two things going on. Number one, the smaller items were actually going for a lot more money than they thought, because people were excited about having a Rockefeller item.
Right? Yes, yes. They wanted, but even so, instead of, there was like a $2 million estimate for the furniture, et cetera, and it came up at 12, but it's still only 12 million bucks.
No, but I understand. But where they fell short, you told me, were the paintings, where the real money might have been, and but the collection was somewhat old-fashioned in terms of art.
Well, it didn't fall short. It just didn't break records the way perhaps, you know, something for a more modern taste.
Right.
Rothko, Basquiat, Warhol.
Right. But he, because when he was collecting modern art, when he was doing it, it's no longer modern.
It reflects the taste of a different generation.
Right.
I mean,
right.
These are still selling for tens of millions of dollars.
But they're not record breakers.
So that was all very interesting. And of course, the one item we enjoyed hearing about the most, that little money clip with the New York skyline.
I was going to buy for you for Mother's Day.
And that had an estimate of $1,200.
I would do it.
It went for $75,000.
Which I won't do.
You know. And there was a story in the New York Times about, you know, just kind of, you know, some fairly everyday people, line cook, and others going to the auction and thinking, all right, this has an estimate of $400. Maybe, you know, I can get it. And instead going for like $2,500
or more,
$4,000 or whatever. One fellow flew here from San Antonio. I think he's a lawyer. You know, lawyers have the big bucks. And he actually bid on a bunch of stuff and finally ended up with a chair. And he's delighted, you know, and he got it for $30,000. And he says he may need to reupholster it.
Of course, it's another $800.
Except that probably the upholstery on it, you know, if it's one of those important pieces, it might have like sort of original upholstery.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll let him work
it's from George II era, so that may be a faux pas. He should check with Antiques Roadshow before he does that. Anyway, it seems like a huge success. And then, update on the Taj Mahal.
Yeah.
And we talked a few weeks ago about the Taj Mahal getting a mud bath. And it needs to be cleared off because of pollution. And apparently, various, I guess, the India Supreme Court has been faulting the country's archaeological conservation body for failing to protect the Taj Mahal, okay? There's apparently some kind of algae on it now, and it's not clear how the algae is getting there. They thought it was bugs landing.
Right.
But it seems to be, the waters have these algae. How does the algae get on the Taj Mahal? And it was asked in court, does it fly? And anyway, there's a lot of rage about it's taking a long time. Taj Mahal still not clean. Is anybody doing anything?
Well, you know what they need? They need the Central Park Conservancy because, as you put it before, it's all about maintenance.
All right. Elizabeth Barlow, get your butt over there and clean up.
All right.
Help them clean up.
Just a couple of quick things. Number one, for those of you wondering how much you have to shuffle playing cards before you play poker or any similar game.
I do sort of wonder that.
And there's an answer.
And all right.
The answer is 7 times. Okay, and now let me explain.
Only 7?
I have to give you the
context. That seems doable.
They're shuffling. Okay?
I thought you were going to say like 52
times. Okay, let's get clear first what we mean by shuffling. We're talking about a riffle shuffle. You know what a riffle shuffle is?
I have no idea.
Okay, this is like describing a spiral staircase with your hands behind your back. So I'm going to try it. I'll read the way the Wall Street Journal does it. A riffle shuffle is when you divide a deck in half and you apply pressure to the back of the stacks with your forefinger and riffle each side with your thumbs. Drop a few cards at a time into a common pile. We all know what that is.
All right, so that's normal shuffling.
A riffle shuffle, not the normal shuffle. So we're talking.
That's how I do it.
No one can see that.
You do that thing throwing them back and forth. Again, no, I don't do the throwing back and forth thing.
The riffle shuffle. Okay, so we got that in riffle shuffle.
I am a riffle shuffler from way back.
Well, it turns out that people have it in their heads that if you do it just a few times, you're okay. And the answer is you're not. They say that a guy used to make a lot of money. He was a chicken farmer. But he used to travel around, and he would take out a new deck of cards, and he would ask someone to pick something from the new deck of cards and place it on top, and he would cut the cards and maybe riffle shuffle one or two times, and he would say, I'm going to pick out your card, and he would turn over the cards, and he would pick it out, and he would win, a lot of money, and here's why. Because a new deck of cards is assembled by suit, all right? Mm-hmm. So you have 1 to 12 or 13, however, 4 times. So it's set up that way. And what he learned by trial and error, from chicken farming, I guess, was that the riffle shuffle wasn't as effective as people think. So if you riffle shuffled three times and you turned it over, it wouldn't disturb things so much, and you'd be able to pick out the one chord that was out of sequence 84% of the time.
Okay.
All right? So what does it tell you? Three times is not enough. The answer is seven. You have to riffle shuffle seven times, and any time more is that much better. And the people in Vegas have tested this because they don't want to waste time shuffling, but they feel they have to shuffle seven times. So keep that in mind. Riffle shuffle seven times if you're serious about your poker dear.
All right. So, before we go any further, we haven't mentioned the royal wedding.
Oh, yeah, really?
Which is coming up Saturday.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we may miss it.
Yes.
You know, there is going to be coverage from 4 a.m.
Yeah.
And I remember getting up to see Diana's wedding, Diana and Charles.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I did not get up for, Harry's wedding. No. Is this Harry or William? I don't even know.
You're asking the wrong
But guy. Anyway, so... But that's coming up, and that should be fun just because you want to see the hats, right?
Right, yes. Okay,
Speaking of hats, the one game played in the water with great hats is water polo.
That's right.
Okay, and all of our kids have played water polo. Some of them continue to play,
right,
even today in their old age. Fun article about a young woman, Maggie Steffens, who's just 24 years old. She's an American, and she has gone to Hungary to play professional water polo.
Well, apparently she's won everything you can in the U.S. With respect to water polo.
And American women have gone to Italy, Spain, and Greece, but Hungary is really top of the line
right. In
terms of water polo.
They appreciate water polo players.
Yes. They have more Olympic gold medals than men do. Five more than any other nation, for example. So this is really amazing. She has her work cut out for her. Some of the girls speak English, but not all of them.
Right.
So there is that. But what I thought was impressive about her was the coach was saying what makes her better than most, if not everyone, is her vision.
Right.
Her ability to see the whole pool, to make the right decisions with the ball, delivering to the right people at the right time. All the great ones share the similar attributes. Gretzky, Magic Johnson, they're the best at making everyone around them better.
Well,
which I think is a great way to approach greatness, making everyone around you better.
And she's a better swimmer than Gretzky.
Hats off.
So there you go. Yeah, well, BC, I mean, look, her big point was that they really appreciate water polo in Hungary. I think she's been injured. She hasn't even played that well. But that's where you go if you want to be appreciated as a water polo player.
Yeah, she says you can't, during a game, you can't talk.
Can't hear.
Or hear anything.
People excited.
The crowd is going nuts. And she says her immediate reaction was, this is so cool.
Yeah, all right. Good for her. And finally, we'll close on the Preakness. Now, I know there's been a little bit of talk about our previous insights with respect to the Kentucky Derby, where we sort of
anybody made a lot of money from your advice.
Right. I hope they didn't lose money. We mentioned Mendelsohn. Mendelsohn came in last. It's hard to pick the last place finisher in the Derby. There are 20 horses. The odds are against
you. Oh, so you feel...
Let me explain. I have looked it up. Mendelsohn, it turns out, was collided with by another horse coming out of the gate and then collided with another time around the first turn. So, but for those bad breaks, he probably would have won the roses. But who knows? It's not about sour grapes. Mendelsohn was sent back to Europe, and he'll be back in the fall. So maybe it wasn't for Mendelsohn. Who knows? It's very hard to pick these races, and the Derby is impossible to pick unless you want to pick the favorite, which we don't do that. We don't play that game. So I'm not going to give you a pick for the Preakness. I'll give you a horse to think about. And here's the logic. You know, a lot of people make the mistake. They don't want to bet the favorite in the Preakness. They want something a little more interesting. And they say, well, who looked good in the Derby? It just didn't quite make it. And that's not usually the way to do it.
Okay.
What you want is a fresh horse.
A fresh horse.
A fresh horse. You got to look at a horse who didn't tire himself out in the Derby. Who's coming in fresh.
And are you going to choose Mendelsohn again?
No. Because Mendelsohn's in
Mendelsohn
Europe.
Was last?
No.
Mendelsohn's
in not
Europe?
Fresh. You got to pick a horse.
On vacation?
You're not listening.
Or hiding out.
You're talking about a horse who didn't run in the Derby.
Derby.
Walter Mendelsohn didn't run. Okay. But in any event, here's the horse, Quip. Just keep an eye on Quip. Quip.
Quip.
Q-U-I-P. Now, a lot of things
not
happen.
Not Quisp.
No.
Okay.
Quip. Not Quip. Quip. It's not that hard. But here's the thing. This horse is kind of, he's had some medical problems. They thought about running him in the Derby. He didn't run in the Derby. He's fresh. If they let him run, he's ready. He could still get scratched between
with
now
enough
and the
drugs,
Derby.
He can do it.
Butazolamide is the drug of choice they use in that race. Banned in New York.
But allowed in Maryland?
Yes.
Oh.
It's but in any event, if Quip runs, take a look at Quip. That's all I'm saying. Enough said, as we say in the business, okay? Until then, enjoy the Preakness, and we'll see you next week.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper.
Thanks.